VentureCast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Pop culture, subcultures, music, horror,
sex,
politics, art, and overall bad ass.
This is Society 13, redefining podcasting.
Music.
Horror.
Subculture.
And overall bad ass. Welcome to Kettle Whistle Radio. With your hosts, Dave and Sean.
I've been on coffee all morning, and so I figured just keep up with the coffee. I know tea is the way to go, you know, and after talking to a lot of vocalists these days, yeah, you want to get a little honey on the back of your throat. And you
definitely. Your...
Folks, friends, and fiends, welcome to Kettle Whistle Radio, a very special one right now. We're going to have a guest very soon. But first, I want to introduce my co-host this time around. He's been on the show before. He has been published by Burning Bowl Publishing. The same label as our guest coming up very soon, John Russo, of course, from Night of the Living Dead fame, Return of the Living Dead fame, and of course his reboot of the film, his own film, Midnight. Right now I want to introduce, though, my co-host today, Paul Wargelin. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing well. How are you today, David?
All right. We're doing this thing remote because, well, yeah, COVID is still out there. It's the Apocalypso story arc through this series of Kettle Whistle Radio. But, and of course, you know, unfortunately, we're going to have a big show with Martise here. And John Russo, of course, himself was going to be sitting right here on the third rail with us once again. But because of COVID, we're taking precautions. He's at his home. I'm at mine. And Paul, where are you? In Jersey, New York? Where are you at?
I am in Jersey.
Yeah. So there
Paramus,
you go.
New Jersey.
Paramus, right. Very important to note, folks, that Paul is responsible for me getting to know who John Russo really was early on. I, of course, saw Night of the Living Dead as a kid with my grandmother before I knew Paul. But later in life, I would get to know Return of the Living Dead because Paul introduced me to the vinyl version of the soundtrack before I even saw the movie. And as we all know, when you hear soundtracks or read books, your imagination runs with you. And you don't know what to expect. And then Paul, I guess, either rented or owned the film on VHS and invited me over. And I saw Return of the Living Dead. And that was my introduction to actually John Russo. Other than seeing him in Night of the Living Dead and his repertoire there. Right, Paul?
Yeah. My introduction to John was also Night of the Living Dead, which my older brother, Brian, had tormented me with as a young impressionable child. you know, night and dawn and day.
Yes.
And I remember him being older, so when Day of the Dead came out in 1985, he and his friends went to see it in the old UA and Corum.
Oh man,
theater. That was one of the few places on Long Island that were showing it, in Suffolk County, where David and I grew up. And even though I had already been imbued with the zombie stuff and the stuff didn't bother me, there was no way I could get in to see it in the theater. And that was one thing that always ticked me off because I was too young.
Right.
And this was back in the, it wasn't released as X, not then. It was just unrated. And so it was no one under 17.
Yep.
Was allowed to go in, and they were pretty strict about it. So, but that same year, Return of the Living Dead came out, and that was an R. Mm-hmm. So I had no problem getting into that one. And again, my brother and I both went to see that. And yeah, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was fantastic. It predates Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead fast zombie phenomenon by well over 20 years. And that soundtrack, that mm-hmm. punk soundtrack by, yeah. you know, the Cramps, the Damned, SSQ, Rocky Erickson. I mean, it's just, I still listen to it. I still have the vinyl.
Yeah, yep. Glad to hear that.
Yeah, I downloaded it to my iPod. So
right.
All that stuff. And yeah, my copy of the film, I think, you know, VHS, I taped off of, it was under HBO or Cinemax back then in the late 80s. Uh-huh. But yeah, I have not picked up a DVD or Blu-ray copy of it yet. Mm,
right.
The current Blu-ray is out from Scream Factory.
Oh, really?
Which does a fantastic job of, you know, horror films to begin with. All, you know, they get new 4K scans of these things and talk to all the surviving filmmakers and get new interviews and so on and so forth. So I was reading the, you know, special features that come with Return of the Living Dead. I think it's a 2-disc Blu-ray.
Really?
I'm not positive. And they do have one disclaimer that unfortunately the Damned did not allow their song Dead Beat Dance to be used on the Blu-ray. I guess, you know, rights issues and all of that, which of course is something that's happening across a lot of media.
Yeah, definitely.
Nobody ever expected these things to, you know, live in perpetuity, which a lot of them are doing.
Absolutely. On top of all that, like I said, Mr. Russo will be joining us very shortly here. I just want to say this, though. We've come full circle because, again, I never thought we'd get this opportunity. You know, of course, Romero is gone now, and we miss him greatly, of course. And, you know, they say never meet your idols. I didn't get to meet George, unfortunately, but I got to tell you, some of the guys I have met, you know, whether it's Savini and now Russo, and like, it's just like, and John Amplis too, who also shows up in Midnight, the original. Just meeting these guys, it's just, it's larger than life. I've met like, some of the cast from Night of the Living Dead and the Crazies, and working all these Living Dead weekends up at Evans City, and something I want you to take part in. So I thought it was really important that you get to do this interview with Mr. Russo himself, give you this opportunity, because, you know, you kind of opened up my world to his work, even though I did see Night of the Living Dead, not realizing who and what I was watching at that time. I think I was 6. But yeah, so... And of course, Dan O'Bannon had a lot to do with Return of the Living Dead, and that was his buddy.
But
maybe you'll get him talking about that. I don't know. Return of the Living Dead. Who knows? But we're gonna
we'll have to see. I mean, I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, to talk to John. I was fortunate. I met George twice at two different events, probably nearly a decade apart. Mm-hmm. And the second one was a Living Dead celebration. And so I got to meet, David Emmy and Ken Foray, yes. Adrian Barbeau, Joe Pilato, Gary Carr, all these guys. And they are just the nicest bunch of people.
Yes, they are. Gracious to their fans.
Completely just, gracious to their fans, down to earth. And they clearly love what they do.
Yes.
And it just absolutely shows. And they were all just very fun to chat with. And, you know, they were up for, have a photo taken and so on and so forth. And just, you felt like you were among a family. And they all treated each other that way. And I know that's a cliche in a lot of these instances.
No, I'm here to tell you, you're spot on. That's how they treat each other in person. I see them at the festivals, yes. But... before we get to it, because our guest should be calling in shortly, are you ready to interview Mr. Russo?
I think I am. I think, I think what I'm just going to let him go.
Yeah, that's one thing. We have to be careful with that. And I'm going to tell him, you know, we're not doing politics on this one. That's going to be on the pop off with Martise. This is a 2-parter. She was supposed to be here. So we're going to be handing Mr. Russo off to Martise after this interview. and you'll get to go, tune into the pop off when you want to hear the rage of Russo.
I like that.
Oh, I'm telling
you. Call this episode the rage of Russo.
I'll have to tell Martise that, but it's we're clearly going to be talking about Midnight, and you probably have some questions for him, I hope, and he definitely will have some answers. I can guarantee. But folks, friends, and fiends, thank you for tuning in. And stick by us for John Russo, Mr. Night of the Living Dead himself, and the reboot of Midnight, which will be available soon. Got my screener. And all right, stick with us. We'll be right back.
Come on, give me a break. Will you, please?
Not over your dead body.
When I was young, I chased the girls, and I caught one or two in my time. But now I'm too slow, and they run too fast, and they're scared of this face of mine. But I still need love, and I still like sex. All that I readily admit. My needs are strong and not too complex, and I'll trade tat for tit. A roll in the hay is a really good thing, and that you should never forget. While you're young or you're old or in between, you should take all that you can get.
This is Kerry Means, the voice of Frylock. And you're listening to Kettle Whistle Radio.
Zom, 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 zombie doobie, zom, 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 zombie doobie, zom, 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 zom.
All right, folks, thanks for hanging in here. We have the legend right now on the line, okay? John Russo is back on Kettle Whistle Radio. John, it's so good to hear your voice again. I wish we could see you.
Yeah, it would be a thrill, wouldn't it?
It would be, actually, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But this dumb COVID, you know?
Yeah, I know.
I know. Well, I got with me, Paul Wargelin is with me as my co-host. He is an Uber fan. And what can I say? Paul, you want to say hi to Mr. Russo?
Hi, John. It's a pleasure to get this opportunity to talk to you. And thank you for taking time to do so today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Well, anyway, I just so you know, Paul introduced me to your work pretty early on outside of Night of the Living Dead. And it came by way, of course, Return of the Living Dead, which we've talked about on this show many times. And then Midnight came along for us a little later, even though that was before. And we both are huge fans of the original Midnight. I just want you to know that. Right, Paul?
Yeah, I kind of know. Every time I'm at a convention and, you know, people come up and say how much they like the film, and then they post about it on my Facebook pages and so on, and they even like the music. And the music's very good, actually, by the Soundcastle. So yes. Recently, I mean, a couple of years ago, I guess, the music was remastered and re-released by a British company with a really, really good artwork. On the album cover.
Is that right?
Vinyl. Yeah. And we used some of that music in the original music in the Midnight 2020. That's what I call Midnight 2020.
Okay, right.
It's still called Midnight, you know, but I just to distinguish them. It doesn't say Midnight 2020 on the artwork or the DVDs or Blu-rays.
Right.
It just says Midnight.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, the soundtrack definitely sticks out.
The whole film is very effective. It's still so resonant today. I mean, I felt, you know, I watched it recently, and I felt, you know, this could be something from, obviously, today's headlines in 2020. And
still happening. Serial killers and people that capture women and all that stuff.
I was going to say.
It goes on and on and on. It's deplorable. I was kind of inspired by, I think anyway, if I can have the chronology right, but thinking about James Dickey, Deliverance, you know?
Of course.
James Dickey made a comment at one point that people have an intense fear of being set upon by strangers. And that's basically what Midnight is all about. But I don't like to just have, you know, people being captured or killed one after another without some dominant theme to the story. And I think, you know, the idea of a strong theme to whatever you're writing or producing is what sets it above the other stuff that's just, you know, let me have a killer and he'll kill one person after another and there's not much character development and so on and so on. Those kind of things don't stand out and generally now don't succeed.
Right. When I first met you and I interviewed you here at Helm's Deep, I said how much I thought Rob Zombie borrowed from you with House of a Thousand Corpses and the Firefly family. I thought it was a huge influence on Rob Zombie, whether he said it or not. I just felt that. But you, back then, you took on misogyny, systemic racism, religion, incest, Satanism, backwoods mentality, racial misappropriation, all back then. And this is what, it was shot in 81, but it has a 70s feel to it. But just amazing.
Well, these things have been going on for the entire history of the human race. So, I'm a very well-read person, an educated person, and social, political, and cultural issues are of intense interest to me, and so that's what I write about, one way or another.
Paul?
Yeah, I think that absolutely comes through in your work, and certainly here in Midnight. I have the Overlook Film Encyclopedia of Horror, which was edited by Phil Hardy. And this version's from 1993, but they have a very good overview of your film and a very flattering review of it. After her policeman father has tried to rape her, Nancy, Melanie Berillin, leaves home to hitch her sister in California. On the road, she joins up with two young men before falling victim to a backwoods family of devil worshippers who plan to sacrifice her at midnight on Easter Sunday. Not unlike 1971's Race with the Devil, Midnight is an effective mixture of road and horror movie with a refreshing break from the increasingly rigid formulae of many of its contemporaries. Scripted by the writer of Night of the Living Dead, and with Tom Savini's usual excellent special effects, the film continues its predecessor's stress on the racial issue by having the racially mixed trio encounter prejudice on the road and by making several of the family's victims black. 40-star Lawrence Tierney is excellent as the heroine's stepfather, initially the villain of the piece, at the end her stalwart protector. And I really think that's a fantastic review of the film.
Yes, I've never read that.
I was just going to say, John, I bet you never read it.
Yeah.
He doesn't read anything.
The dominant theme of Midnight really is the issue of, you know, it's religion versus superstition, and begs the question, are they just two sides of the same coin? You know, I don't believe in any religion. I don't really believe in the supernatural. You know, and I think people can be deluded in either direction. And the people in the Midnight, the movie, and the novel are deluded in opposite directions, and that's the that's the main conflict, and that's, you know, the novel goes into that in more detail. I had hardly any money to make the movie. It was basically made by me and three other people. It was me, John Rice, and Eric Baca, and Paul McCullough,
right,
with a few other people that helped out on certain days, but not very much. In fact, Savini didn't do a whole lot. You mentioned his special effects, but he didn't do them all. He sculpted. He he brought me the skeleton parts, the skeleton and the skeleton parts from some, from another movie that was being made at that time, and so I used those parts, and he sculpted the face of the dead mother, which was actually a mistake.
Oh no!
It's I'll explain that, but and then he left to work on to be in Knight Riders.
Oh yeah.
So the rest of the blood effects and the gunshot effects and all that I did.
Yeah.
So that's just I had to do that, but it's interesting not to dump on Tom, but you know, to make a point for young directors or any kind of director, the special effects people often tend to think that their effects are the movie. And they, when it comes time for them to haul out their artificial constructions or whatever they're doing for the movie, they bring the stuff. They march the stuff onto the set with great pride, and, which they should feel, yeah. You know. And it's fun to work with them because they get completely involved in what you're doing, and they're enthusiastic and so on. But in the case of that mother, I was talking to Tom about the effects that needed to be done, and I said the mother, you know, is the idea. It's supposed to be a shock that you meet these people when they're kids, and then I don't have a chyron that says 20 years later. It's supposed to be a shock when you realize that these are those same kids
right, grown yeah. up
and five times as evil as they started out to be. Mm-hmm. And so you need to realize that it's the same people. When you see the mummified mother, you're supposed to recognize her from having seen her in the front of the film. So Tom was saying, well, I'll make a mask, and I'll do this, and I'll do that. And you know, when people are mummified, a lot of times they turn black. And he said, I'll do that. And I said, Tom, wait a minute. You have to be able to recognize that woman as the same woman you've seen in the front of the film, only she's aged by 20 years and mummified, but she still has to be recognizable. Well, he showed up with a mask, and I couldn't stop. Production. I didn't have the money to shut it down, and so I'm waiting for 5 hours while Tom gets that mask on Jackie Nicol and so on. And of course, you can't recognize her as the same woman. I showed the movie to George Romero.
Oh no!
In his office, and true enough, he was kind of distracted thinking about business things. But he said, "Who are those people?"
Oh, geez.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that's funny. I'll tell you what, there's another funny story. I just finished putting this story in a novel that I'm doing because it's one of the funniest things that I've ever happened to me making a movie. Paul McCullough and I were editing Midnight in Bill Heinzman's office at the time. He had an editing suite there, and we rented it, and Paul and I would come in real early in the morning, and it was in a professional building downtown Pittsburgh where there were a lot of dentists and lawyers in that building, and then this one little film company, and film equipment had been stolen, so they had installed an electric eye that would ding if somebody came into that hallway. And so Paul and I are, you know, in T-shirts and jeans and so on. We don't look like dentists or lawyers. And we're running, we're going to put an edit in the scene where the black kid, Hank, gets kicked in the balls in his sleeping bag. And
yeah.
The fake cops are beating up on him.
Yep.
And he's screaming. And so you're hearing these screams reverberating in this little room as we roll the soundtracks back and forth over the sound reader, and then the bell dings, and I roll back my chair, and I look down the hall, and it's a fairly long hall, and there's nobody there at first. And then this guy in a suit and tie pokes his head around the corner, and he's got a scared look on his face, and he says, are you the dentist? There was no goddamn way that he wanted me to be operating on his teeth.
So, that's awesome.
We just cracked up.
I love it.
It was hilarious.
It doesn't get better than that.
What?
It doesn't get better than that. It really doesn't.
No. That's about the funniest thing I can think of out of many, 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 many movies.
So with the reboot of Midnight, I'm just curious, are you going to be following some of the same themes? I mean, I watched it. I don't want to give spoilers, but some of the same themes here between the racism, the incest, the race, systemic racism, backwoods mentality. Are you tackling the same things and corruption?
Oh, you're asking me a question assuming that the people listening haven't seen it.
Correct.
Well, first of all, Gary, you know, we almost had this movie financed a number of times, and one of the times was that Rob Lucas's, Rob was one co-producer with me and Gary on My Uncle John is a Zombie.
Yes.
And Rob's, Rob's mother was going to advance him enough money out of his potential inheritance to make the movie. So I go to Stamford, Connecticut, where she was and where Rob grew up, and I had the location scouted, and I had a great cast lined up, including Serena Vincent was going to play the witch, for example. She was going to play the Cynthia character. And I get that, and when I get there, his mother's on her deathbed.
Oh, God.
That's when I met her on her deathbed. And I drove back to Pittsburgh. She passed away, and the estate got tied up in probate and everything. And so we never made the movie. And there were several other things that happened. That's typical of the movie business, you know.
Yeah.
Things are going to happen, then they don't happen, and blah, blah, blah. Then recently, Gary Vincent said that he would like to make it on a low budget and shoot it digitally and direct it. And I would be an executive producer, and, you know, of course, I wrote the screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary has been doing a great job. He's been doing many, many movies.
Yes.
Shooting digitally and getting them into distribution. That's a long story, but it's an education in and of itself.
I should probably add, John, that, again, Gary Vincent is Burning Bowl Publishing. He's our publisher. He's our label. And I've been a great guy, you know, and go on. I'm sorry.
Well, I have seen some of the stuff he's doing, and I mean, a lot of people think they can direct them. Most of them can't. Gary can. He's very good. So I had implicit faith in him. I was, because of the COVID thing, and, you know, he had to work through the COVID thing and everything else to do this movie. I didn't have to do much. I had already written the script. I played the part of the priest.
Yes.
In the original Midnight, you don't see the priest. You just hear his voice.
Right, right.
This time you see me as the priest.
That's for sure. I love that scene.
Gary just did a great job. He had to make adjustments because of COVID and the difficulties of getting certain scenes and populating certain scenes when you're supposed to have social distancing, all those things. So there's a supernatural element to the new Midnight.
Yes.
That I didn't want in the first one, because I'm dealing with the banality of murder, you know, in the down-to-earth aspect of it, the fact that there are no miracles, and nobody's coming to save you, and there's no goddamn Satan either, you know.
Yes.
You know, but the new version does have, very effectively, it has a supernatural element,
mm-hmm.
and it works. You know, it's really entertaining, and it's, I think, eminently marketable. I think it's going to do very well, and the whole cast and crew and everybody that worked on it under these trying COVID situations is to be congratulated.
Yes, I enjoyed it thoroughly. I own a copy of it. I got the Blu-ray.
Well, thanks. Glad you have it.
Absolutely. I was looking forward to it. And we were just talking, Paul and myself, that, you know, they say never meet your idols. But right now, Paul is actually meeting one of his right now. You should know that. It's very important that you know that. Yeah.
Well, thanks. I always say I put my pants on one leg at a time like everybody else.
No, this is a real pleasure, John, you know, yeah, and listening to you talk to me about the making of this film. And it's funny because a moment ago you mentioned how in the original that, you know, nobody is coming to save you, yet you have Nancy's stepfather who tries to basically rape her in the beginning of the movie and then turn around and come and save her, which I thought was really fascinating aspect of the character. And you're giving a lot of levels to his humanity. And I thought that was a really daring approach.
The first edit of the movie, in the novel, Nancy dies. She's in the cage, and you know she's going to die. And the way we shot the movie was the same way. She's left in the cage, and you know she's going to die. And then whenever I went to New York, Paul and I went to New York to show the film to Sam Sherman, Independent International Pictures. Sam, first of all, said, "Well, he said this is you guys are to be congratulated. This is not only a good horror film, but it's a good piece of film, period." And he said, "But we'll never get an R rating if we let the girl die. So you know, can you come up with a different ending that still works?" And so I wrote this ending, and we brought Lawrence Tierney back, and I had a drop a scene where he lies to the mother and says that he never found Nancy. In retrospect, I could have left it in because he still could have lied at that point, but still his conscience gets to him and he does come back and save her and dies in the process. In the new midnight, he goes to confession, and the priest, tells him he has to atone and he has to make things right and all that, which was not in the original midnight, but it just gives him more motivation to have his turnaround and go and try to save Nancy. So one of the things in the new script couldn't be done because of COVID, but Gary really compensated, you know, to still preserve effective screen time, and he did things a little bit differently. And but the thing is, a lot of people, a lot of directors, they do things that don't make sense.
Mm.
But everything Gary did made sense. And it worked, and that's a hell of an attribute in you. That's an attribute you need if you're gonna be in this business. Some big name people don't have it. I mean, what they do is they shoot everything and dump it on an editor.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true.
So the original Midnight, I had IIP would send me three or four 400-foot rolls of film at once, and I was always running out of film. It was shot on a 4-to-1 ratio. Night of the Living Dead was shot on a 6-to-1 ratio. But that means four times as much film was shot as ended up in the movie. That's, you know, that's normal. You're going to have more film shot than what's...
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, I always got safety tape, at least one good safety tape, and so on, and then you have blown lines or whatever. But then the other thing, I was always driving all night borrowing film because I'm always running out of film, and the film they sent me is spool down, and you probably don't know what that is, but film laboratories use 2,000-foot reels. And then somebody will go into a dark room and spool them down into 400-foot reels. And if they get a light leak, then you're going to have blotches on your film.
Hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
So I lost a lot of my best takes with light leaks.
Oh man.
On top of it, so you know, one of the things was that even with safeties, so for instance, when Nancy hits Bert Tierney with the radio, I had a good hit that was convincing, but I had to use a hit that wasn't as good and wasn't all that convincing. So I had him collapse and then start to snore, which would, you know, make it more believable that he
sure.
was ready to pass out anyway.
Yeah.
That definitely comes across in that scene because the character had been drinking.
But that's
just a small example of the kinds of innovations and, you know, spur of the moment things that have to be done to rescue a scene, and I'm very good at that.
Yes, you are.
Gary is also. Some people aren't so good at it, and they do things that don't work. So.
Right.
That's that.
I noticed too, John. Just because I'm from the area, a lot. Did you use a lot of the same locations on the reboot?
No.
No.
None.
None of them. Not even like when they pick a girl up.
The reboot was shot in around Clarksburg, West Virginia.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Gary lives in Clarksburg. His day job is he's a techie, very skilled technician.
Yeah.
For the FBI.
Yes. Should we have said that?
I'm not afraid of the dark, but you should be. There are things that dwell here in the dark. Things best left unseen.
With the initial smoke clear from the fall of tomorrow, the blood now flows even thicker with dwelling in the dark. 11 stories. All bits of the same mysterious puzzle. Fitting together with horrific parallels to its predecessor. Get ready for new, truly terrifying tales set in the broken world from the fall of tomorrow. Take a closer look at what's now dwelling in the dark. If you dare. Available on Amazon in traditional print and ebook. Get your copy today. Visit www.fairlydarkproductions.com for more info on the author and his work.
Cinnamon Charles. Sit back and bask in the wackiness of Boku Askew TV. A YouTube channel featuring sock puppets, irreverent comedy, bizarro imagery, and oddball silliness aplenty. To watch now, visit youtube.com/BokuAskewTV.
Thanks for watching Fashion Trash. I'm Cinnamon Charles.
Zom, 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 zombie doobie, zom, 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 zombie doobie, zom, 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 zombie
doobie, zom. Hey, when they pick up Nancy in the beginning, though, I swear to God, the location looks so much like the one in the original. It looks so close.
Yeah, well, he was trying to, as much as possible, to honor the original movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think it's a mistake if you try to honor the original too much, then why remake it?
What's the point, yeah.
That's the good thing about his remake, that it does go in this different direction, but yet it pretty much, you know, preserves the feeling of the original. It was shot almost the same way. It was a, you know, very low budget. I mean, he's shooting digital. I'm shooting 35 millimeter. But,
yes.
But I'm doing it on a shoestring, and he's doing it on a shoestring all these years later. So, you know.
Well, I was telling Paul that I was actually very honored to get onto the soundtrack to My Uncle John is a Zombie. We did your vocals right here in Helm's Deep. I'm hoping to play that at the end of our interview here. But I also was telling Paul, too, that you had not only the luxury of killing me, blowing my head off in that film, but you had the luxury of gloating to my own father that you killed his son. He came to visit a convention. He still thinks it's great. Yeah.
I can't remember.
No, you meet too many people. But he remembers. He loved every moment of it. Paul, what you got with the old Midnight? I know you got more to ask him.
Well, actually, the one thing I'd like to ask, because you've been speaking a lot about Gary. So was it your idea to revisit Midnight, or was it Gary's?
To revisit the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Did you? Was it your idea to do this remake, or was it Gary's?
Do some of the things that I couldn't afford to do way back, you know? And Gary liked the original movie and so on, and he said that after doing this string of low-budget movies that he's been doing and successfully getting them into distribution, he decided that he wanted to do Midnight, and he just feels very strongly that it's you know, going to make money and so on, and it looks like he's going to be right. So I was glad to let him do it, you know, give him pretty much free rein. And in fact, it was totally free rein. So I told him I trust you implicitly. You know, we've been friends and partners for probably 10 years now. And
at least,
you know, he's one of the people that I trust the most.
Well, the story and the themes are timely and sadly timeless.
Timeless, yeah.
You know, again, just watching the original, it feels like it could have been shot today, even that original version of it. You know, that we just, the issues of racism and you know, people who are deluded by religion and family strife. I mean, you know, this is what we get 24/7 on the news anyway.
Yeah. So that's true. It's in rustic locales, so it doesn't betray the time period so much.
Exactly. Yeah. So it still, you know, has that resonance.
Yeah.
Do you have any specific stories you'd like to share with us about Lawrence and John Amplis or other members of the cast?
Lawrence Tierney, I could see right away why he was a star of in Hollywood heyday, and you know, he played Dillinger in the movie Dillinger, and he had a big career. Scott Brady was his brother, and he told me back then that he kind of dropped out of acting to give Scott a chance, you know, because they were always considered going after the same roles, and they were the same type as far as actors. And but he actually, I learned from him just by watching the way he played his part. He didn't necessarily memorize lines word for word. In fact, he almost never did that. He would get the gist down and the key story points down, and then he would say the lines, you know, just let them come out naturally. I did the same thing with the Uncle John movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the thing is, I'm the one that makes people laugh when we're on stage and all that.
That's for sure, yes.
It's unnatural for me to play that character. I'm almost the one that had the plan.
Yeah, I could vouch for that, absolutely.
So, and that's the way I did, you know. I mean, I'm really good at the extemporaneous stuff, and that's what makes people laugh. when we are on stage, so I just did it, and
yeah, Paul. Honestly,
I was talking to Chuck Corby the other day, and Chuck was the star of my movie, The Mob Boss and the Soul Singer, the original title, The Lunatics. And Chuck said that's what he did too. You know, he did the same thing.
Yeah, I went to that premiere. That was a great premiere.
He's like a Joe Pesci type, and.
Yes.
And he and Joe Pesci actually had the same manager, Joe D'Onofrio from Youngstown, Ohio.
Okay.
But Joe's a big force in the industry, Grammys. So, but, and I think I would guess that Pesci does a lot of that. A lot of his, he's just great, and it's he probably ad libs a lot too, but he really doesn't. I don't know that for sure. I don't know I've never met him. Funny thing, I did see him without knowing it. back in the 70s.
Really?
Russ Dreyer and Rudy Ritchie and I went to New York for some kind of thing. And while we were there, the Electric Circus was a big deal. And the YMCA guys, YMCA.
Oh, God.
Oh, the Village People?
Village People.
Yeah. We went and saw the Village People. And we went to the Peppermint Lounge and saw Joey D and the Starlighters. They had the Peppermint Twist, right?
Yes.
Well, I didn't know till Chuck told me years later that Joe Pesci was in that band.
He was
one of the Joey D and the Starlighters.
Yeah,
I saw him.
That's incredible. I wanted to tell Paul and also other our listeners out there that don't know Chuck Corby is a crooner, a local crooner. He's an amazing, amazing singer. And first time Mr. Russo came in here, he came with Chuck, and we played some of his music too. Paul, definitely worth looking into some of Chuck Corby's stuff.
Okay, I'll make a note of that.
Cool. A new album coming out in January, and it's all with live musicians and no pre-recorded tracks, and people like Kenny Blake and trying to think now. I can't think of the other names, but they're well known. But anyway, they're all great musicians. I haven't heard it yet.
That'll be a whole nother show. We'll have you guys on.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He's been working on it for about a year, recording in the Keysport. There's a studio called Mojo Boneyard Studio.
I know it.
Fabulous studio.
Yes.
Yeah, I recorded, Chuck and I recorded my Eve of Destruction song there.
Yes. Oh, Paul hasn't heard that one yet. You know, I want to mention this too. You were talking about yourself on the set. Now, here's the thing, Paul. When you go, if you're on a Russo set, it doesn't matter if it's 14 hours, it doesn't matter if it's 8 hours, it doesn't matter if it's 20. He keeps you entertained, okay?
do I?
Yes, you do. Yeah, yes, you do. You absolutely do. Whether you're just have a way. You're a natural, and those hours disappear. You just wait for your next scene, whatever. It was a pleasure working with you, and I had so much fun. I've been on a lot of sets at this point. Most fun was yours. I'm just going to say that.
Well, thanks. Well, absolutely. We appreciate everything you contributed in the way you. You know, all the things you did, all the things everybody did on a low-budget movie like that.
Thank you.
And I think we all can be proud of it.
Yes, yes, for Uncle John. Now, Paul, I'm sure you got a couple of midnight questions left for him.
I said just anything you'd love to share about the making of it and how you would compare filmmaking from then to now. And ooh, how the story has evolved.
Going way back, Russ Dreyer and I, and Rudy Ritchie, when we were partners, one of the things we wanted to do was we wanted to become our own distributors, and we made some efforts in that toward that end. But it cost millions of dollars to really distribute anything in those days, and 35 millimeter prints and. 1,000 prints that might cost $7,000 each and all that stuff. So we didn't get that off the ground. And also I like the small productions.
Mm-hmm.
I often, there are big spectacles that I love, like Rome, the entire series is just great. But I like making those movies with a low budget movies with a small cast and so on. That's just more kind of me. Mm-hmm. So, but now there's amazing grassroots filmmaking taking place all over the country because of digital production.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary is one of the more successful people with it in that. But I've acted in several movies, small parts, in the last few months, even with COVID. I played, I was in a movie called Devil's Den, before COVID came out, just before, and it was in Hagerstown, Maryland. A great, really good director and great staff, and they knew what they were doing, staff and crew. And I, a few weeks ago, I was in a movie being shot in Charleston, West Virginia. I played a doctor telling, it's called Return of the Mothman.
Ooh.
And the Mothman legend started in Huntington, West Virginia. They didn't have a statue of the Mothman in
Point Pleasant
town there.
Absolutely.
Which I didn't know. But anyway, my scenes were shot in Charleston. I played a doctor breaking it to this mother and her grandson that she's dying of, she has terminal cancer. And what else?
Well, that's something to look forward to big time. I can't wait to see that.
But the thing is, the people are very accomplished. You can tell they really have it together. You know, a lot of this kind of work is being done all around the country. There's some bad work being done, too, but there's a lot of good work, and the digital production makes it possible. So, and that's right up my alley, and one of the reasons why, you know, I said right away to Gary, yeah, go ahead and make Midnight and do it your way. So, and we're going to do more. You know, we have more things that we want to do. At the same time, I'm writing some stuff that does take a much bigger budget.
Okay.
So, one of the differences, like in the original Midnight, I've got three or four rolls of film at once, and I'm shooting on a 4-to-1 ratio. Well, that takes a lot of skill because I have to know where my master shot's going to go, where my mediums are going to go, my close-ups. I'm not shooting every take all the way through the whole scene. Can't afford it. Mm. Woody Allen or Martin Scorsese, they shoot 25-to-1, and now they have all this material. And a lot of even big names that don't really have a sense of how to block their scenes, they shoot every damn thing and dump it on an editor to rescue them.
Right.
Okay, so, but the people that I, in the films that I was in recently, not with digital, it's so cheap, that they, every single camera setup, they shot the whole scene all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to act the scenes out from beginning to end over and over and over and over and over again. Where it would have been a faster shooting day to break it down into where's the master going to be and where's it, you know, and so on. So that's different. It probably results in a pretty smooth product in the end. I don't know what else to say about that.
No, that's perfect. I
would say that it, you know, back when you were filming, you know, the original Midnight, or, you know, even obviously as far back as Night of the Living Dead, you had to be more, not only economical, but more efficient with how you would shoot these scenes
budget.
And then put them together.
Budget.
Well, George was basically calling those shots. I wasn't quite ready to direct a feature film at that point. And so George was the director, and he did a fabulous job. And he also was the cameraman. That's the way we worked. And if I was doing a directing a commercial or a documentary or whatever, I was the cameraman and I was the editor too. So that's how we work. But George, we would rehearse things and block the action and rehearse and practice follow focus or whatever we had to do, and then we would shoot. But and a lot of times, toward the end there, whenever we were running out of film, and George was just winging it. A lot of that stuff was one take.
Period. Amazing, amazing.
And the farmhouse was going to be bulldozed to the ground when we were done. And if we'd have gotten scratches on the film in the lab or anything else would have gone wrong, we'd have been screwed.
Oh my God!
But George was so skilled at what he was doing. And we also lucked out because we didn't get scratches and blown takes. And that's how, no, who in the hell is going to do that now? Well, I hear Robert Rodriguez supposedly did that with El Mariachi, which I thought was a really, really good film.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tried to strike up a conversation with him at the Land of the Dead premiere, and I as a prelude, I said, you know, I read that this film was done on, I forget, $16,000. I said, that's kind of hard to believe. Whatever the amount was that they were publicizing, I meant it as a just to introduce the conversation to find out from him, well, how did he manage to do that? Because it can't be done. You know, maybe he had equipment donated, maybe he had lab resources donated or something.
Right.
Instead, I sat down and he turned his back on me and walked away.
Oh, no.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, no.
What an asshole. But he may not be an asshole.
Well, at that moment in time, he was.
I have to agree.
You would think one filmmaker to another that he would have.
Meanwhile, Paul doesn't know this, that you, one of your biggest fans is Kirk Hammett of Metallica.
I did not know that.
I don't know if he's seen Uncle John or not. He said at one point that he likes everything I do.
Yeah.
And I reminded him of that. I sent an email, and I sent it to his right-hand lady.
Okay.
Shelley Veneman, and asked her to send the link to Kirk, and I haven't heard anything, so I don't know if he's seen it or not.
Okay. We'll have to look into that.
You know, eventually he may comment on it. I have a feeling he's going to like it, because it's right up his alley, you know?
I'll have to have my people talk to his people.
Yeah.
You know I have that kind of clout. Oh, man. But, hey, you know, we should tell folks here where to find your stuff that's for sale right now. Are you still selling Return of the Living Dead scripts and books?
Yeah, I don't know if I have them. I don't have them anymore, novels.
Okay. Oh, boo me. Okay.
But the scripts I think they may be listed on eBay.
Okay. But Burning Bowl Publishing has a lot of your new stuff, correct?
Yeah.
So Burning Bowl Publishing.
Course, they have the movies. You know, they have Heartstopper and The Mob Boss and The Soul Singer.
I own all those.
John, Midnight.
Yep.
Majorettes. I don't think they have majorettes.
That's a good question. I'd like to know the answer to that. Yeah.
Well, Lionsgate has the rights to it, and to the majorettes, and people ask me about it, and they used to bring it out, reissue it occasionally, and I have no idea what they, wait a minute, they don't have the majorettes, they have Midnight.
Oh, the original.
Yeah, at one point they were going to reissue it and wanted me to do commentary tracks, and I didn't want to do them without getting paid.
Yeah.
Because they've made a ton of money off of that movie.
Yeah, give me a break.
And
what the heck?
They wouldn't pay, so I didn't do them, so I don't know what the hell they're going to do.
Boo that. Okay, well, I'm glad we know that now. Anything else in closing, Paul?
Again, thank you, John. This has been fantastic.
Just about everything, I guess.
Just about. Paul's got one more for you.
No, just wanted to say, John, this has been fantastic. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. And it's a pleasure, you know, meeting you, at least virtually. I hope we can do it in person someday.
One of my current things, I wrote a screenplay called, in a novel called Rufus Buck.
Okay.
And we're on the verge, hate to say it because, you know, things go through their paces, but it looks like we may get a budget in the millions to make this movie. It's a Western horror story, but it's based on a true story.
Ooh.
And so I have a friend of mine working up the budget now, which is what the investors want next. It's already had a bunch of readings, some small revisions, which I did, and they loved. So it's so far so good.
Okay.
But Rufus Buck was... there was a gang of five mixed breed black and Creek Indian teenagers, and they went on a raping and killing rampage that lasted for 19 days in 1895, when it was just awful, the things they did. And they were caught, and Judge Isaac Parker at Fort Smith, Arkansas, the hanging judge, sentenced them to hang, and they were, all five were hanged from the same gallows in 1896. And that's, so I have a fictional story built around that that's full of twists and turns and intrigue. And, you know, some people said they thought that it was one of the best things I've ever written, and I
myself. I'm pretty sure that, yeah, Paul and myself, our ears just perked up just then, I think. So, yeah, we're already looking forward to that. You know what we should talk about real quick? What's the release date for Midnight, the reboot?
I think it's already considered to be in release, I guess.
Okay.
You know, can talk to Gary about it. More specifically.
Okay, and the Blu-ray is available?
He's selling the DVDs already.
Okay, so go to, folks, burningbulbpublishing.com. Check it out. You can find all our stuff there. My stuff, John's stuff, of course. I by the way, John, I do have a new comic book out called Dr. Peeler, Demon Psychiatrist. That's also at burningbulbcomics.com. Issue number one, issue two and three are on the way. It's fun. I don't borrow from your monsters. There's a little dedication to you in there, by the way, and Dr. Peeler.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
We loved what we do.
Yes, indeed we did.
Some things, Sam Sherman told me a long time ago, he said, not everything we do in life is successful. Well, that's a good thing to keep in mind. Some people get discouraged and bitter and never do anything. So you just have to ride with the blows and keep going, and you know, and you'll have your successes by and by.
It doesn't get better than that, Paul.
Yep.
I agree. I think that's great advice for everybody who wants to do anything and get themselves out there. And just turn your mistakes into opportunities.
Take the dive.
You know, and learn from everything that you do.
Take the dive.
Right.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for doing this. And I hope to God that me and you can get a table again sometime and represent these conventions. Aren't you looking forward to getting back out there?
Well, I have about 15 of them lined up, really good ones lined up until COVID hit. I got back from England March 1st. And then everything started to be postponed and canceled. So,
yeah.
Who knows? A lot of the things have been moved into 2021, but who knows if they'll happen.
Right.
All right. Well thanks a lot.
All right. John, hey, thank you so much for doing this, and we appreciate it.
Well, I love you, darling, love to munch on you. I want you, darling, to make a lunch of you. I need you, darling, I need to munch on you. Come into my heart. I need you, darling. I want your body parts. Come here, darling. Let me munch on you. Well, I never, yes, you see, I never ate nobody like you. I crave your body. Yes, I crave your body. Strawberries and whipped cream, too. Make my dreams come true. I need you, darling. I want to munch on you. I need you, darling. I'd love to munch on you. Hey, babe. I ain't the Big Bopper. I ain't Elvis Presley. Ain't Chuck Berry neither. This is your Uncle John. Love all the things you got, and I gotta have some. I want want you real bad, babe. I want you real bad. Well, I never, yes, you see, I never ate nobody like you. I crave your body, yes, I crave your body. Strawberries and whipped cream too. Come, 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 make my dreams come true. I need you, darling. I want to munch on you. I love you, darling. I'd love to munch on you. Love to munch on you. Love to munch on you.
Hey there, fabulous souls. I'm Stephanie Baklaan.
And I'm Eden Alpert.
And we're the hosts of the brand new podcast, Unapologetically Fab.
Get ready to join us on an amazing and real journey as we dive into life after 40 and own it.
We're all about changing the narrative, leaning into who you are, and living a life by your own design.
Join us as we embrace life unapologetically and redefine success.
This is Unapologetically Fab,
an Electric Cast production.
See you there.
Electric. ElectraCast.
Have you ever wondered what actually happens in Congress every day? Stay informed on Capitol Hill's daily happenings with a concise, factual summary of the Senate and House of Representatives' activities from the previous session, free from bias, on the Congressional Record Daily Digest podcast. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and discover the process from the heart of U.S. politics. The Congressional Record Daily Digest, an ElectraCast production.
ElectraCast. ElectraCast.